the Society of American Archivists, this is Archives in Context, a podcast highlighting archival literature and technologies, and, most importantly, the people behind them.
Welcome to Archives in Context, where we explore the ever-evolving world of archives and archivists who shape it. This podcast goes behind the scenes to uncover the stories, challenges, and innovations driving the profession forward. From tackling current issues and exploring the transformative power of memory keeping, we bring you conversations with those pushing the boundaries of archival work. I'm your co-host, Connor Casey, head of the Labor Archives of Washington at the University of Washington. I've served in leadership roles with the Society of American Archivists, the Pacific Northwest Labor History Association, and the Northwest Historians Guild. Currently, I serve as co-chair of the SAA Labor Archives section, and I'm joined today by my co-host.
Hi, my name is Adriana Bennett. I'm the Community Engagement Archivist at UNC Charlotte's J. Murray Atkins Library, and I also serve as the president of the Romare Bearden branch of the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History.
And today we're excited to welcome our guest, archivist and educator Julie Thomas. Julie holds a Master of Library and Information Science and a Master of Arts in History from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She began her career as a corporate archivist for Motorola, later working at the Chicago History Museum. Since 2003, she's been at California State University, Sacramento, where she currently serves as the Instruction and Electronic Records Archivist. Julie is also a scholar and a steward of the internationally recognized Japanese American Archival Collection, educating audiences worldwide on the Japanese American experience. Her latest book, Teaching Primary Source Research Skills to 21st Century Learners, is published by SAA and provides essential guidance for educators and archivists alike. Julie, welcome to Archives in Context.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Could you give us a little bit of background? What inspires you to write Teaching Primary Source Research Skills to 21st Century Learners?
That's a really good question. I have been the instruction archivist, both unofficially and officially, since 2006. And over the years, I had to learn by trial and error what was effective, what wasn't. And I think it was 2016 when I had over 80 hours of one-on-one consultations with students after my lectures. And they were coming in asking me about things I had covered in my presentations. So I realized I was not effective. And I started looking around for instruction provided for primary source research, and I couldn't find anything. So I turned to education discipline, looking up theories, methodologies in the discipline of education. And that really helped me a lot. And then I started doing case studies, or study, I should say, where I was experimenting in flipped learning. So I created four videos, brief videos, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, that talk about primary, what is a primary source, how do you locate them, what's a finding aid. And then I gave a pretest, pre-video viewing to 20 of my friends, family. None of them were familiar with primary sources, but they know what they are. They were critical thinkers. And then the pretest, they did about 50%. I was really happy. And then I had them watch the videos and then take a post-test, and they failed epically. As a matter of fact, what I did was the second round, the post-survey, was I was giving questions that dug into theories. For example, the first question is, what is a primary? What are examples of primary sources? It was all multiple choice. And they were easy. Photographs, letters, diaries, and then a dictionary. And they got dictionary. That was the correct answer. It wasn't a primary source. The second time, it was much more cerebral. A mugshot, article of clothing, a ticket stub, or one that really wasn't one, a secondary source. And they weren't getting it right. And the last question was the exact same. It was the exact same question, exact same answers. And whereas in the pre-test, about 50% of them got it right, in the house test, 90% got it wrong. So I realized my instruction was not working at all, because that's primarily my audience. They're introductory historians, the upper division. They've decided that they're historians, but they're learning the research process. So that's when I really started digging in and trying to find what was the most efficacious way to teach them the skills. And I just kept getting feedback, learning more. So I had something to say. I wanted to write this book based on my experiences, what I learned along the way, especially from outside of the archival experience, because there is really nothing written about it, and really explore and define a lot of the challenges and that I faced and how I was able to address those challenges.
Wow. So this is really interesting. So I'm finding that based on your own individual experience, you were noticing that there was this lack of consensus or uniform approach. And then you also did assessments from different stakeholders and found that they weren't retaining it, and then used it to inform your approach. So wonder whether you can share some of the biggest misconceptions of educators and students, what some of their biggest misconceptions are about working with primary sources that you found?
Yes. And the very first one is the misconception that working with and about primary sources is about working about primary source research skills. When you work with primary sources, you're using that as a supplement to other instruction. We're not really teaching what is, how do you do research? And the first huge misconception that I realized is we're not teaching what is a primary source. And so I spend probably half of my presentation just, what is it? It's so nuanced. I used to spend 5 minutes. This is a primary source. This is the definition. Here are some examples. Any questions? No, move on. But I realize that they don't know. I've created 4 new videos. They have to watch, they being students, I work faculty, they watch it beforehand, and half my presentation is, what is a primary source? And at least once in every presentation, I see or hear somebody go, aha, ah, I didn't know that. Because they think, oh, the newspaper is written at the time of an event. That's a primary source. Not true. I try to teach the nuances and of just a primary source. That really caught me off guard, that I didn't realize I needed to explain that really in depth. So that's not, it is teaching about primary sources, but having them learn how to use it in their research process and differentiate it from a secondary source.
We're talking a lot about the resources themselves and getting students to understand, but can you talk about what you consider a 21st century learner? How do you define that term? And then how does their research needs differ versus previous generations? And how has it changed since you've been doing this work as well?
Yeah, originally my book title was just Teaching Primary Source Research Skills. And then I realized my audience is instructors of 21st century learners. And it's very different than how I learned. I'm a baby boomer. And so first off, an umbrella term is we have to teach them how they learn. They can't learn how we teach, because that's not the case. And of course, there's the information overload. They live online, truly. And I've read many research articles, ironically enough, from the United States. They're all from all rest of the world, where one actually said, students said, would you rather live without air and water or your phone? And they chose air and water, that they could live without air and water, but they couldn't live without their phone. But if you look at the science, neuroscience, that's going on, is that their brains literally think different than ours. Everything is fast-paced. How do we teach them, and how do they assess what they're looking at, evaluate what they're looking at? How did they discover this information? And in addition to just how they learn, the way we teach differently is that information is no longer just information. Hardware, software, they are algorithms. They're part of the equation. And if you don't talk about that, you're not understanding how they learn. So as instructors, we need to understand how they learn and then get over what we're seeing now with misinformation, alternative facts. I start out with fact-checking, which is the opposite of critical thinking. You just do this real fast and you're just verifying the authority, the authenticity, the biases of the source. And I always just say, throw out any subject, any topic, and it never fails. The very first thing I click on, I go upstream, lateral reading, and sure enough, I find out it's from some conspiracy theorist or somebody who's ultra left-wing or right-wing that have a bias, but they aren't aware of it. So it's real quick fact-checking, and they need to do that because they haven't been imbued with, at this point, the critical thinking skills vis-a-vis technology and online research, which is what they use.
You're identifying this mix between being really savvy and being naive in a way. And I feel like what I love is that you're locating the purpose of archives in society, really, because in this time when you can't be sure what the source of anything is or its veracity, having that chain of custody really speaks to the purpose of our discipline.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So they learn differently, and I've been able to forge relationships with students through the years, as well as I have a lot of nieces and nephews. I have 5 sisters. So lots of nieces and nephews. So they feel comfortable sharing information that they know is embarrassing. Yeah, I get my information from my Instagram friends. I understand that algorithms, how they work, but I'm okay with that. I'm a liberal. I don't want to hear conservative points of view. They know it's not good research. It's not good information seeking nor information receiving, and yet that's how they operate. And then, of course, engagement. Lecturing absolutely doesn't work. You have to have active learning experiences, engagement. And, you know, a lot of people from my generation disparage that. And it's, this is what it is. And if let's use Kahoot. Everybody says, we want games, learning games. Kahoot, it's free. Use it. So those are different ways that learning and instruction have to change.
Kahoot is quite fun.
Yeah, and it keeps them engaged. They have to engage with it rather than just standing. I use the phrase, sage on the stage, no more, guide on the side. That is how we have to proceed.
So your book has an emphasis on inquiry-based learning, and you talked about this a little bit with how everything is just in front of you're being fed the information versus going to seek it. So can you explain what that looks like in practice while you're teaching?
That's a very broad question. I'm not going to go into my whole origin story, but in 8th grade, when I knew I was going to be a historian, I consider myself a historian first. And the most important part of being an archivist is somebody asked my professor, teacher, asked me, why do we study history? The pat response is so we don't repeat it. And he said, no, so that you don't believe everything you read, you don't believe everything you hear. And right then, it was like, boom, I was blown away. Especially now, inquiry-based learning and how we can provide that instruction is key. Because back then, I was just looking at books. And all of a sudden, I realized, gee, I'm not a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant male. My story isn't there. It's been silenced. And now we're 50 years later, or I am, and I realize it's never been more important for learners of any age to question what they read, to question what they hear, and then do their own research, which has been driving me crazy. All of these QAnon, I did the research. That is a burr under my saddle. No, you were the victim of algorithms and of self-fulfilling prophecies, if you will. So that's what I'm trying to imbue with all of these learners is, how do you discern the truth versus misinformation versus opinion versus using primary sources, the unvarnished truth? And it's up to you to interpret those.
You address this in talking about your pedagogical framework and also some of the assessments you're using to adjust your approach. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether you can share some of the effective ways to introduce students to primary sources, especially those who may be unfamiliar with archival research. What are some of the strategies that you find to be your favorites?
It depends. I'm going to back up for just a minute or take off on a little tangent, is first do an assessment of who is my audience. Just how many of you have been to an archives before? And if I get more than two people raising their hands, that's a good day. But also, how many of you have done primary source research? Now I understand who I'm dealing with. Just deal with the basics. And that's how I do it and assess it. What did you learn? Are you going to come back? Come and talk to me. It's been informal. I'm trying to create a more robust assessment system. A lot of what I do write in my book, I don't claim to do myself. It's aspirational for me. I just did the research. But so if they're advanced, if they're working on their capstone classes, I'm doing much more in depth. Finding aids, that's one of the things that I address in my book. We call a finding aid a finding, what we consider a finding aid. The box inventory, the biographical history, timeline. And I tell them, yeah, that's an archival finding aid. Understand it, but I'm a finding aid. Anything that helps you find primary sources is a finding aid, and vet those finding aids as well.
Oh, I love that. We could be finding AIDES.
Right. We are. So there's a lot of, I think, terminology and to a lesser degree practices that are still rooted in 20th century. That's just the case. That just aren't relevant anymore. As we've gone into electronic records, how learners learn, there are just certain things, our jargon, and that I'm using that word specifically, even though it might have a slight derogatory connotation to it. As soon as I hear other instructors of archival research, immediately with the jargon, I just look around the room and you see the eyes glazing over. And we have to make our jargon consistent, our own, and specific to our industry, but using natural language, if that makes sense.
So you talked a little bit about Kahoot, but do you have any other favorite classroom activities or exercises that help students engage with primary resources? And you can be as specific as you want to be.
One of my favorites, it's a combination of the old school and new school, so to speak, is I pass out copies of bibliographies to groups. I get everybody in groups. So a bibliography from a secondary source. And with that, I have online. I also have, like I said, old school handouts should they want it, which is keywords that show them how to identify a primary source. My book has 20 pages of bibliography, including suggested readings. How can they use this without going to every single book listed? Working with that, I have them take a page, each group, and try to identify some primary sources. And it's important to me that I say, I don't know for sure. I haven't looked any of these up. It gives them agency. And so I can't say, no, you're wrong. Some of them I can say. The Diary of Anne Frank, that's obvious. But a lot of them, there's a lot of nuance to it. And I ask them to look deep in titles and what are clues. And then we go around the room. It's all peer-to-peer learning. What did you think? Who agrees? And the answer is usually, it depends. If your topic is this, it may be a primary source. Time is our most valuable asset. You had 18 weeks to write a 30-page paper. Do you have been five of them racking down primary sources? This will help you with this. I never tell anybody they're wrong. Heck no. And I show them I fail. It's important for them to realize I've been an archivist for 30 years, an instructor for 18 years, and they see me fail. And then they see me retry and re-examine and try new search strategies. And it never fails. Those students pay attention. They're understanding it. They're synthesizing it. And it's all proof of the pudding. Nobody's coming to talk to me about my lecture anymore. The students, they get it. They just want help creating a thesis. They don't understand hypotheses, but that's a different book.
Sounds like that exercise potentially could be format agnostic. And one thing that occurred to me was that we were talking about the habits and modalities of 21st century learners. And in relation to how our collections are evolving, I'm wondering whether you can suggest how educators can incorporate digital primary sources while still fostering critical thinking and source evaluation skills?
Yes. Yeah, I do that absolutely during my presentation. That's basically the second half. When I say presentation, my sessions. If I'm lucky, I get an hour and 15 minutes. If I'm really lucky, I'll get two classes. But like I say, I always invite students to come in individually. Faculty love it. But the second half, I talk about the different types of digital repositories. So using, for example, California Digital Library. When I submit information to the CDL, it goes in two directions. One is the Online Archive of California, which is a clearinghouse for finding aids. They're basically for savvy researchers. How do you read a finding aid, a box list? How do you understand the context of the information you're finding with the whole collection, which is important if you're doing in-depth research? But the CDL also sends things to what's called Calisphere, and it's just a digital object. It doesn't show context. Finding aids you can send, it clicks through to our repository, and then they can find the finding aid. But nobody cares, really. They just want a picture of a Japanese-American farmer from pre-World War II. Bam. So I teach them about those different type of digital repositories, and again, how to vet them. What are you going to find when you get there? Again, make sure it's a source that's trusted. And then how do you interpret it and integrate it into your research? A number of my faculty I work with, they don't require that their students work with any paper. They allow them to work only with digital material. Make them come to the archives. So I'm prepared for whatever your learning objectives are, bring them on. I got you covered.
By doing that kind of dual instruction thing where you're showing finding aids, so that's the, you know, metadata and description and context, and then the digital objects, it seems like you're modeling one of the domains of archival intelligence in that all of our work is really providing context for the things that you could happen across without context, which is what we're really adding to those primary sources.
Yes, it's absolutely true. But I think that archivists in the past have treated all researchers with a broad brush.
Right.
Not only are in classes individual, what is the curriculum that they're expected to learn, their learning objectives, but within the class, there's different learners at different levels, if that makes sense. And it's always been an issue with me that professors have to provide equal instruction. They've got 30 students who are writing 30-page papers, but it's not equitable. Some learners, they just learn differently. So I've worked with enough faculty that they know I have time. I can spend as much time with students as needed, and especially neurodivergent, because it's stigmatized. They don't come out and say, oh, I have ADHD. Having dyslexia, everybody can say that loud and proud. But some of these neurodivergent issues, they have to suss them out. And then I figure out, how can they learn? I work with the faculty member and tell them, I'm not giving them the answers. They are going to get their A's and B's, and they're going to earn it. And I can do that. When it comes to, I don't know if that answered your question, but dealing with how to provide basically efficient instruction that's going to help everybody that I talk to. I can't have 100% success, but I can shoot for it.
So thinking about how other librarians and archivists can, I don't want to say replicate your work, but take what you're giving an example of, and how can we help educators teach research skills for their students?
Okay. That question is exactly why I wrote this book. You'll see throughout it, I say anecdotally, observationally, empirically speaking, it's meant to be a jumping off point for discussion. I could be completely wrong, or this may only be applicable to me, my institution, and the audience I'm talking to. What I'm hoping is that they can look at some of the theories, some of the examples I put forward, and say, oh, I can tweak it from this, or she is so wrong, but let's start the discussion. Maybe I need to start writing papers or writing articles, not about teaching with primary sources. How do we teach students how to use them? I come down hard on LibGuides, teaching packets. You're not teaching them access, discovery, locating. And it's such an important part of doing research. So that's what I am hoping, that other instructors who read this are those who aspire to become instructors, or like me, I had no choice. You're going to do it. And then I realized quickly they'll believe anything you tell them. So it made me be more cautious and careful and selective about what I do teach them, because they will believe anything you say. And the other thing that I'm hoping that people can take away from this, people being the whole profession, is how disjointed it all is. I'm looking at, between my competencies and literacies, there's 20 of them. And a lot of them sound so much alike, but there are nuanced differences. And again, even us, we're seasoned archivists. Can anybody really say what's the difference between analyze, contextualize, and evaluate? What are the differences? The differences, TPS, there are three different organizations teaching with primary sources. It took me 2 days to figure out who was, what did they offer. It's, I don't want to use the morass, but it's, there's a lot of information. People are doing great stuff, but it's all completely disjointed in their own, I don't even say silos. People are just doing what they can, and that is very laudable. It's just we need to coordinate it, simplify it, and provide guidance for those who are doing it and are going to be doing it more.
I've got to say that I love that part of your book, that you took the time to actually really in detail outline the differences and overlaps between these organizations, because I've attended my own conferences for one of those manifestations that teach you have primary sources, and I can't tell you that I really understood the difference between the different manifestations. So I really appreciate.
Yeah, so much is frustrating. And especially, I taught as an adjunct faculty member, history grad class for archives and manuscripts. And the first half was working with physical collections, the second half with electronic records. And it was so frustrating for the students that I kept saying, it's all the same. It's just a different format. Don't stress about it. And yet the language is so different. Accession, no, ingest. It's going to be a user, no, a consumer. Yeah, and there's all apes, sips, dips. It's just after they're, I'm telling them to do the same things, apply theory to what you're doing, and it doesn't matter if it's ones and zeros or woodpulp. And yet it does if you're trying to understand those theories, because it's the language is different. Pedagogy is different. Again, there's a lot of stuff that I can see needs to be addressed. It's not going to happen overnight. This is a jumping off point to say something we could maybe think about to streamline.
In your discussion before about the differences within all algorithms and information seeking behavior and not understanding it, and also the way in which if you have a passive approach, that algorithm can actually be weaponized against you if you don't understand it. I think this sort of relates to that, which is that I think often we find their students are relying on Google searches for fast one-stop shopping, the uniform one box. And I wonder whether you can share the approach that's worked for, with you or the, in your research about this, how educators can help them slow down and engage deeply with historical documents.
That's great. As a matter of fact, I made some notes and there's a quote about algorithms that I found and I used in my book that we now are an age of class of people who use algorithms and those who are used by algorithms.
Ooh.
And there is a big difference. And as I was saying, starting out, if they find a primary source online, let's start with digital. As I was saying earlier, fact-checking. It's called lateral reading. So Julie Thomas wrote a book on teaching primary sources. Open up, just immediately open up another tab and put right in Julie Thomas archivist biography. Who the heck am I? A Russian dissident? Or am I, who am I? What is my authority in writing this? And so doing and going upstream. So that quote that I used just now, class of people use algorithms versus people used, I cite it. Who is that person? Follow that upstream. Oh, I saw that it was stated by John Smith. Who is John Smith? Where? What was the original article he wrote it in? Was it peer-reviewed? Whatever. Real quick fact-checking, but then onto it, I start out with scaffolding approach to teaching students about how to do in-depth. And this is how in-depth analysis, and I make it real fun for them as well, them being the students. I do use NARA's primary source analysis. So I pick really interesting to me, and time has shown that to them too, objects, documents, material, need it, analyze it, and then interpret it. And we'll spend as much time, I'll go over it with them, then I have them do it. Then I'll put things on a table, and group learning is always the best. Peer-to-peer is absolutely the best way for them to learn and to reduce their anxiety. Learning, failing, relearning, and coming up with methods that work for them, if that makes sense. So that's what show, engage, they're engaging too. And I say, I don't give answers. I just say, you look at this. What are you seeing? What meaning do you have? And then I may give a prompt. What was the time period this happened? What was going on back then? And allowing them to dig deep into it. And then when it dig deep into the primary source. And I think it's very important for them to learn as well. Number one, there's no smoking gun. If you find something that clearly states the answer to your hypothesis, then it's not original research. So I had to tell them, don't look for the smoking gun. You have to interpret things that support your thesis. And I teach them that the same source can be used for two completely different research topics. So the Japanese Americans at the concentration camp in Canada, I have a researcher who is studying the art of the Japanese gardens they built. I had another research came in who didn't care about the incarceration period at all. She wants to see how the soil changed.
Wow.
So I guess it has to do with incarceration, not to do with the morality or constitutionality. She was just like, how did they change? Oh, they irrigated land and oh, they've changed the soil. So the same photos were being used for two completely different research purposes that may not even relate to why it was created. The evidential value of that. Look at the informational value as opposed to the evidential value of it.
One thing that about your group-based instructional approach that piqued my interest or curiosity is that this, of course, could vary depending on the class or the audience. But are you talking mostly about groups that are active during that particular class, or are there also sometimes cohort-based approaches where they're continuing after the class?
Well, my videos are my lecture. And what I've realized is I have to give them a quiz to make sure they read or watch the lectures. Otherwise, they're lost. And during my sessions, it's all group activities. It's all active learning. They're learning from each other. The professor and I were walking around, answering questions, pointing out, or giving them suggestions for the questions they should be asking. And then most of the time when faculty bring their class tests, it's for use in an end product. So they're coming back, hopefully, to use archives, our archival, or to help me. They're good at locating it now. I've taught them how to do all that. But they do come back in for group projects, and I'm thrilled when I see blogs. They're in to create a blog. They're in Sac State has, what do we call it? Not performing arts room, but a room that has cameras and you know, all the apparatus you need to do websites and YouTube videos. So we're trying to get them to think. And have to get them to think outside of traditional products, they do it. We have to learn the end product is not going to be always a research paper. And more, it's not going to be. So how do we evaluate the efficacy, what they learned? Did they get it? That's the most important thing. Did they get it? And that we have to assess and learn. And I'm still working on.
When understanding whether or not they got it or not, as you're going through the class, what are some of the most common mistakes that you see students making or even just the biggest challenges that you see them facing while they're analyzing primary resources?
This is a minor thing, but it's not so minor anymore. They can't recursive. And I'm the home of primary sources, the Japanese American Archival Collection. Most of the material that came from those that were incarcerated is written in cursive. So they're asking me to translate. I'm not going to translate a 50-page document. All of these newsletters that were handwritten, that is an issue. And so it's basically, I'm saying, one of your family members you get to translate. Change your topic, and if it's just a couple of pages, I will translate it. But But then they're trans. I can't believe I'm saying translate. It's English. But that has become a huge challenge. And I've even had two professors who can't read cursive. Mm-hmm. They were STEM, but it doesn't matter. But that's a challenge. The other one is, as I was saying earlier, is coming up with the thesis statement. They know about what is a primary source, how do I find it? What is a thesis statement? And it always starts out with, I'm going to do a timeline. Or I'm going to restate. I did research and I'm going to restate everything I learned. No, you have to come up with an original idea and then use primary sources to support that. And so again, my job is to guide them along that path. They know they want to write about the illuminated manuscripts and the transition from in the Middle Ages from being God-centric to the Renaissance and science. How do they look at these illuminated manuscripts and interpret that? What is your hypothesis? Got to come up with that and then use this illuminated manuscript. And but the thing is, they're so excited about it. And I get excited. And the next thing I know, we're all excited. And they all come back. And yeah, a lot of them come back even afterwards to see all the awesome stuff we have.
I love how your last chapter was pointing to next steps and direction. So I'm going to ask you a super ambitious question. How can educators attempt to future-proof their teaching methods to keep up with changes in research tools and technology?
We as archivists need to have that starting with education, like it's not taught anywhere, any MLI schools. And the reality is most professors all over in academia, they're experts in the field, but nobody taught them how to teach. So we're experts, archivists, and more as we're becoming very functional centric. So there's a metadata archivist. There's the reference archivist. We all have to know about these instruction techniques. So I think, because it all ties together. And so I think that's where it starts, is education and scholarship. It took me 4 years to write this book. From beginning to end, the book proposal was a full year. It was gnarly. But just kept going research, because you're my peers. I think that you're not going to believe. You're going to question everything I say, my peers. So I want to make sure I can back it up or clearly say, hey, this is just my opinion. Whatever. So education, scholarship, and the sharing of ideas.
As we look further into the future and even in the present, a lot of libraries and archives are starting to talk about AI. What does that mean for the profession? But I wanted to know, with AI and other digital tools becoming more prominent, students are using them more. How do you see the landscape of primary resource teaching and research evolving?
I have to be honest, I don't know. AI became a thing after I finished reading this book. So I don't feel like I know enough to get on to talk about it that much. It absolutely is going to change the way things go, but who knows in what manner, good, bad, how do we react to it? How are we proactive? I don't know. Are we scared of it? Are we excited for it? Is there a mix of both? And I took the easy way out. I'm retired. I retired, but I get to come back for 6 months, a year. And it sounds really cowardly, but I don't have to know about it. So I am looking to my colleagues to take that torch, be the torchbearers, and I want to read about how it's going to affect everybody in every aspect of archives. So it's not a great answer, but it's the only one I got.
Yeah, in some ways, it solidifies the importance of archives because it's not something that, I mean, it can be digitally doctored in some way, but for the most part, everything is still, the manuscripts are forever, unless there's a fire.
Now we've digitized it.
Yeah.
Locks, we got that locked down. And again, more important than ever, teaching our learners and us as professionals, is this good information? Was the research done? I know a number of professors who are totally down with AI. They just said, we want you to know what you're talking about. But if you want to use AI to write the paper, you go. It's the Wild West. And I don't know the answer to any of that. And I'm happy to just sit back, read a novel, drink some tea, and then come back every once in a while and do some processing. Awesome. And instruction. I do still do that. I process and do instruction. That's what I do when I'm back for 6 months.
You talked about how much legwork that you put into even conceiving of the book proposal and also writing the book. And that is so clear. This is, I just really appreciate what a straightforward resource this is. And also the list of articles and the comprehensive bibliography and further reading that you've created. So that's all there in the book. And I just wonder whether you could recommend particular sources in this very detailed bibliography that you found useful that we can begin as we all try to build our skill sets around this sort of call to action that you've written.
Yeah, absolutely. You cannot overlook the giants upon which we're standing on. Schellenberg, and that always kind of bums me out when students, even if they don't know the name, which I'm old school. I'm like, even if you don't know Schellenberg, his appraisal he was talking about, I think that's key for instructors, as well as what's coming up, our new era of thinkers as well. But I found really interesting, it's, what is it, PL, Provocative Series, Barbara Pfister. And it's escaping me the name of the actual online publication. She's just part of the Provocative Series, I think, issues, Provocative Issues. And they're just questioning everything. They're questioning everything in through the lens of where are we today? So anything that makes us think about what's still working today, what isn't working, what was a good theory, but in practice, when I hear archival students talk about, for example, documentation strategies, great theory, it didn't really work in practice, but people are still using that terminology. So an answer to your question is, I don't know. Look at the areas that would urge people to look at the areas that they want to. Is it learning about literacies? Is it about pedagogy? Is it about assessment? See who I'm citing a lot. And there are things being written all the time. Like I said, it's being written outside of the United States. You have to dig deep to find what's going on in Mumbai. But they're ahead of us right now in dealing with this. In Egypt and the UK. So that's what I would recommend is, and then of course there's online sources. Teaching with primary sources is pretty awesome. I don't want to say that they're not valuable. They're amazing. We just have to take it a step further.
What advice would you give to educators who are just starting to integrate primary source research into their teaching?
Are you talking about like archivists, librarians, or anybody?
Anybody.
Okay. If it's just anybody, and by anybody I'm talking about, that's also personalized, is working. I work with my faculty. What are they teaching? How do they define primary sources? What do they want to learn? So that would be the first thing is work. If you're an instructor and you're doing one-shot sessions or you're an embedded archivist, what is the faculty member? What is their expectations? What do they want? If you're dealing with, for example, like a K through 12 instructor, what are the requirements, the legal requirements that you have to teach? As we know, they're changing. If I wasn't in California, there's a chance I could be arrested for teaching critical race theory because I am telling students that the United States did something shameful when they incarcerated Japanese Americans. I could be arrested for that. So I have to be aware of local as well as institutional organizational parameters and be aware of your audience. And then just tailor everything from that. The other advice is don't freak out. There's so much to learn. Like I said, don't believe anything you tell them. Just don't give them bad information. It's okay to say, I don't know. It's okay for them to see you fail. I've actually found it to be helpful. I've thrown in a swear word now and then. And they all giggle and suddenly I'm their buddy. The cool 60-year-old. Find out what's best for you, for your audience, for your institution, and for you yourself, too. What's going to make you feel when you go home, I made a difference today?
Sounds like a good note to end on with the warm feels. Where can listeners find your book and how can they connect with you in your work?
Excellent. Sure, they can get it through the SAA website. Obviously, in there is the physical and the electronic copy. Amazon.com has it, although I recommend everybody please go to SAA website. But Amazon, last I looked, I don't know if they had the ebook copy on it. So right now, those are the only two outlets for that. And for me, just the best way is through email, and that's jthomas1@csam.edu. And I love to chat with everybody or anybody who calls. I always have something to say.
Julie, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your expertise and for the expertise that you already shared in such detailed and really accessible version through your book. This has truly been a fascinating conversation.
I've enjoyed it myself, too.
This has been great. And I know our listeners will have some good takeaways, and they'll probably be calling and emailing you.
Right on.
And thank you to our listeners for listening to Archives in Context. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe and check out past conversations with archivists shaping the profession.
You've just listened to an episode of the Archives in Context podcast, the official podcast of the Society of American Archivists. Members of the podcast team include Mary Caldera, Adriana Bennett, Connor Casey, Lauren Cada, Emily Maffei, Camilla Zoria-Tesler, Carmela Furio, Kate Greenberg, and Hannah Stryker. All opinions expressed in this podcast are our own and are not reflective of a particular institution. Be sure to subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts or at archivesincontext.archivists.org. And join us again next time.